Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from People Mover. Help update the public transit service plan. Visit transitonthemove.com to take the latest public survey by April 26th.
We're going to agree on the things that we can agree on, things that just fundamentally make our elections better.
The Alaska legislature nears the finish line on a bipartisan election reform bill. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, March 24th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, the community of Tuntutuliak gets refueled as it rebuilds from Typhoon Halong.
People were using their dryers, trying to dry up their stuff. More heaters, contractors.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
The PFD application is open. Just a small amount of your PFD will help share local news and stories about Alaskans with Alaskans across this great state when you choose Alaska Public Media through Pick, Click, Give.
The Alaska legislature is on the verge of passing a significant bipartisan election reform bill. That's after the state Senate passed it last year and the House voted it through Monday. The bill is a compromise many years in the making. It would make a variety of changes to the way Alaskans vote, and it's likely to head to the governor soon. Alaska Public Media's Eric Stone is in Juneau and joins us now to walk through the bill. First, Eric, what's the point of this bill?
So, Casey, it is a very broad bill. It's a big old compromise, and it has been in the works for a long time, as you said. Anchorage Democratic Senator Bill Wilikowski was one of the main sponsors behind this latest iteration.
We're going to agree on the things that we can agree on, things that just fundamentally make our elections better. And after 10 years, I think this bill does that.
And the general idea, to steal a phrase from a conservative who played a big role in crafting the bill, Homer Republican Representative Sarah Vance, is to make it easier to vote and harder to cheat.
We aren't trying to get a certain outcome with this. We are boiling this down to how we conduct elections so that each voter, regardless of how they vote, has the confidence that it's going to count and that it's going to be secure and that the voter rolls are going to be accurate.
All right, stage is set. So you said the idea is that it makes it easier to vote and harder to cheat. Let's start with how it makes it easier to vote.
Okay, so most of the changes are related to absentee voting, you know, voting by mail. One big thing to take note of is that the bill sets up what's known as a ballot tracking and curing system. So right now, when you send in an absentee ballot, you have no idea what happens to it once you drop it in the mailbox. This bill would set up a system that allows voters to check and see whether their ballot was received by the Division of Elections. And for the curing part of it, it's not like curing meat or measles. It's if you make some minor error on your ballot envelope, like you forget a witness signature or make a mistake with your ID number, the Division of Elections would reach out to you and give you a chance to fix that, to make sure your ballot counts. The Division of Elections says fewer than 1,000 ballots had curable issues in 2024, and about 500 of those were tied to witness signature issues. And I should note here that this ballot tracking and curing system would come into effect for the general election in November. The division says it's too late for now to do it for the August primary. Also notable for absentee voting in this bill, it would provide postage-paid envelopes for absentee ballots. The Division of Elections estimates that'll cost the state $50,000 or $60,000, but Representative Calvin Schrage, an Anchorage independent and another major backer of the bill, says that's well worth it.
It's not just a matter of whether or not individuals can afford postage. There are oftentimes communities that you can only buy stamps at one or two places, and sometimes they run out.
And there are a few other things, making it so the Division of Elections can pay poll workers more to, address how hard it is to staff polls in rural areas. You can use a tribal ID as your voter ID. And it makes it so that you can actually write in a candidate for president. Funny enough, that actually hasn't been possible since ranked choice voting and open primaries came along.
Gotcha. Yeah, a variety of things making it easier to vote. Tell us about some of the security aspects of the bill, though. Sarah Vance mentioned voter rolls. What's going on there?
Okay, so this has been a priority primarily for conservatives for many years. There's a fun statistic you hear a lot. Alaska has more registered voters on its rolls than eligible voters living in the state. And there's a reason for that. It can take up to 8 years to remove somebody from active voter status, even if there are clear indications that they live somewhere else, like, they apply for public assistance or register for a car in another state. With this bill, if it looks like you might live somewhere else or you haven't voted or, signed a petition in 2 years, the Division of Elections will send you a letter and, you know, if you don't respond, you'll be placed on inactive status.
So does that mean you can't vote?
Okay, this is important, and it was actually a big subject of debate in the House. You can still vote if you're inactive. Federal law requires states to wait 8 years before removing voters from the master list. You'd just have to vote a questioned ballot, and you'd be moved back to active status. Another thing sort of in the broad category of voter trust and security, the Division of Elections would start processing absentee ballots sooner and report results more frequently. There'd also be a universal 10 days after Election Day deadline for absentee ballots to arrive, though, of course, we're also watching a Supreme Court case that could require ballots to arrive by Election Day. So, you know, stay tuned on that one.
Yep. Had a story from our Washington correspondent, Liz Ruskin. That's at alaskapublic.org if folks want to find out more about that. Talking about this state ballot bill, though, were there arguments against it?
Yeah, some of the opposition was tied to military voters. You know, they move around a lot, sometimes overseas, and they're still Alaskans. But, you know, they could be caught up in some of these efforts to tighten up the voter rolls. But, of course, it's important to note that they could still vote a questioned ballot. There was also some opposition linked to timing. You know, some folks said it may not be appropriate for current elected officials to affect an election that they are going to be running in.
Yeah, interesting. All right, so where do things go from here?
So a Senate up or down vote will send it to the governor. That could be as soon as Wednesday. Of course, whether Governor Mike Dunleavy will veto it or sign it or allow it to become law is unclear. Wilikowski, the main Senate sponsor, says he hopes Dunleavy doesn't veto it. He says he worked with the governor's team on large parts of the bill, but Dunleavy is staying mum for now. His spokesperson gave me a non-answer when I asked him about it. So for now, we'll have to wait and see.
All right, Eric, we're glad that you did not stay mum and talk to us about this bill. We appreciate that. That was our state government reporter, Eric Stone, reporting from Juneau. Eric, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Tunta Tuliak's power plant is no longer short on fuel. Trucks recently plied the new Kuskokwim River Ice Road extension to the community to alleviate a critical shortage. As KYUK's Evan Erickson reports, the community is still rebuilding from damage caused by ex-Typhoon Halong, and how it can afford to pay back the much-needed fuel remains unclear.
After the remnants of Typhoon Halong swept through Tunta Tuliak last fall, causing widespread damage to homes and infrastructure, fuel consumption in the community spiked.
People were using their dryers, trying to dry up their stuff. More heaters, contractors, you know, using electricity to work on homes. Those are the factors.
That's Carl Andrew, who has managed the community's power utility for the past 20 years. He says fuel needs at the power plant increased by roughly 2,000 gallons a week immediately after the storm. In late February, Andrew says he checked to see how fuel levels were doing.
We dip our tanks every year, this time of the year, you know, to make sure we have enough.
Andrew realized the power plant was set to run out of fuel as early as mid-April, which would leave the community without electricity a month and a half before the arrival of the first fuel barge of the season. Around the same time, Kuskokwim River Ice Road crews had completed an extension linking Tunta Tuliak to the hub of Bethel for the first time in 6 years to aid with Halong relief efforts. Andrew says he saw an opportunity. He estimated the power plant would need more than 8,000 gallons of fuel to make it to spring. The sole supplier able to deliver from Bethel over the ice road, Top Fuel, quoted Andrew at $13.60 per gallon. Andrew says the money wasn't there to make an upfront payment. He says he had already been in close contact with State Representative Nellie Jimmy's office for help navigating the federal disaster relief process, detailing storm losses for the utility covered under the Federal Emergency Management Agency's Public Assistance Program.
Drums of oil, drums of coolant, tools in the tool shed. No machine, stuff like that.
But the fuel needs at the power plant were immediate. Representative Jimmy's office proposed what appeared to be the only solution, taking out an additional loan from the state bulk fuel program that the utility already relies on to pay for its annual fuel needs. Representative Jimmy's chief of staff, Rachel Gunn, says Jimmy's office was able to help expedite the loan process. She says the roughly $114,000 price tag for the fuel delivery would be far higher if not for the ice road extension.
The speed of the loan with the ice road and being in good condition and not having gone through a storm was absolutely paramount. Getting that loan process as quickly as possible to get the fuel delivered so that we could get it at that $13.60 a gallon and not have to have it flown in small amounts.
On March 11th, Tunta Tuliak's utility received its fuel. Andrew says he hopes it's enough to make it through until barge season and that he can come up with a way to pay back the bulk fuel loan.
Not too sure, you know, where we'll get the funds to pay for that.
Gunn says Representative Jimmy's office is working with state and federal agencies to find a solution. She says the crisis in Tuntutuliak is a direct result of the October 2025 storm, but that proving this for the purposes of receiving federal relief is tricky.
Even though the day after the storm, the fuel shut up, FEMA's got these incredibly prescriptive requirements for what is able to be attributed to the disaster.
For communities still rebuilding from severe storm damage, the arrival of spring will mean much cheaper barged fuel. Until then, Tuntutuliak has found a way to keep the power on. But without some sort of reimbursement, Andrew says the utility may soon be in the red. He says the first monthly payment for the emergency fuel loan from the state is due April 1st. In Bethel, I'm Evan Erickson.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Juneau students spend spring break rebuilding homes destroyed by Maui's devastating wildfires.
And it feels fulfilling to know that you are helping a community or helping someone out.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
I'm Shelby Herbert, a reporter with the Alaska Desk. That's a joint reporting effort from Alaska Public Media and KUAC, where I work in Fairbanks, and other public radio stations in Anchorage, Haines, and the Aleutians. It allows us to connect you with the issues happening in communities all across the state. You can hear our stories during the morning news, Alaska News Nightly, or online at alaskapublic.org. The Alaska Desk is only possible with the support of grants and listeners like you. Thank you.
The state medical examiner's office is conducting an autopsy on the body of a man found Sunday in a residence in Fairbanks. The Alaska Division of Fire and Life Safety says University Fire Department personnel found the severely burned victim after they extinguished the fire that badly damaged the trailer home. University Fire responded after getting a report of the fire at around 1:30 Sunday afternoon, and when they arrived, they found that the fire had already spread throughout the residence. According to a dispatch from the Fire and Life Safety Division, emergency personnel transported the victim to Fairbanks Memorial Hospital, where he died of his injuries. The state medical examiner's office will autopsy the victim to confirm his identity. Fairbanks-based deputy fire marshals are investigating the cause of the fire. Investigators say no foul play is suspected. The commanding officer of the Ketchikan-based Coast Guard cutter Douglas Denman has been temporarily relieved from their position. The commanding officer, Lieutenant Edwin Custer, was temporarily relieved Monday following an investigation that led to what they call a loss of confidence. Pamela Manns, a public affairs officer with the Coast Guard, said in an email, quote, "The commanding officer was not meeting the high standards of leadership and performance expected of someone in their position," end quote. Manns also clarified that the relief status is not due to misconduct. She said the primary purpose of the relief is to ensure the safety, operational effectiveness, and morale of the cutter and its crew. The temporary relief may or may not become permanent. If warranted, that decision will be made by the commander of the Coast Guard Personnel Service Center. An interim commanding officer has been appointed to the Douglas Denman to maintain all operations. There are four cutters based in Ketchikan. A Ketchikan jeweler will have to pay $60,000 to the state and restitution to four customers for selling fake gold. That's according to a settlement filed in a Ketchikan Superior Court last week. State prosecutors filed a lawsuit in May of 2024 against Sony Inc., which owns Flawless Fine Jewelry in downtown Ketchikan. Company director Sunita Lakwani is also listed as one of the defendants. Undercover investigators with the state purchased what was represented as gold quartz mined in northern Alaska and handmade primarily by Ketchikan-based jewelers. In reality, the jewelry was from Southern California and was often low-purity 14-karat gold and sometimes contained no gold at all. Salespeople also told undercover investigators that natural gold quartz only occurs in Alaska and can only be legally purchased in Alaska, which is false. Assistant Attorney General Ian Engelbeck was the lead attorney on the case.
When a business misrepresents its goods like that, it doesn't just hurt the guests who get fooled by these misrepresentations. It also hurts every honest business that's trying to compete with businesses that are not representing their goods truthfully.
In a permanent injunction, the state also ordered Sony Inc. to truthfully represent the origin material of its products. The company is also open to being audited by state investigators. The store Flawless Fine Jewelry is currently closed and could not be reached for comment. The American Civil Liberties Union of Alaska came to Juneau last week to give training sessions on what to do if residents encounter immigration enforcement actions in town, whether you're a bystander, an employer, or someone getting detained. KTOO's Yvonne Crumry has more.
In a Know Your Rights session at the University of Alaska Southeast, ACLU Alaska Executive Director Mara Kimmel explains the legal nuances of immigration enforcement. Kimmel points to the ACLU's Family Safety Planning Guide, which loved ones can use to know what to do if someone is detained.
That outlines all of the information that should be available to family members of people who might be picked up and detained. So what to do with your kids, where are your critical documents like your passports or your bank accounts or your passwords and all of that.
The ACLU trainings, held in partnership with community organization Hatush Latish Coalition, are meant to help residents prepare for federal immigration officials coming to homes and businesses or stopping people in public. The information sessions come as federal agents have detained and removed multiple Juneau residents for immigration enforcement and separated a family in Soldotna last month. Kimmel says anyone picked up by federal agents has the right to remain silent and the right to an attorney. She advises people to document what's happening with video, if they can do so safely, and to write down agents' badge numbers. For business owners, Kimmel advises clearly labeling private spaces in buildings and making sure documents are not in plain view. If immigration enforcement officials come to a home or workplace, they need judicial warrants, not administrative warrants, to enter private spaces. And this information should be included in a written policy for businesses and organizations.
And so part of your developing a written policy is also to make sure that you're practicing the magic words that you need to utter, which are, I'm not going to let you in. This is a private space and show me. I will only let you in if you can show me a judicial warrant. If they do show you a warrant, you have to let them in.
Kimmel says an individual who hides a person or aids someone resisting federal agents is putting themselves at legal risk. The second half of the training is about bystander intervention. She says one of the most important things a bystander can do is be safe and stay calm when encountering any kind of immigration enforcement action.
And one of the first things to do if you happen upon a law enforcement interaction is make sure that the person actually wants help. Because the last thing you want to do is just get them into further and further hot water.
If the person says they do want help, Kimmel says to ask for their name and get as much biographical information as you can about the person, like their date of birth, country of origin, and alien registration number. Then, she says, the second step is to ask if there's anyone you can call for the person, whether it's family or an attorney.
The third piece is try to document the enforcement action. Again, do this safely. If law enforcement is being awful and egregious, back away.
Kimmel says bystanders can legally record or film interactions and state the date, time, and location for the recording. And lastly, she says, report the action to the person's lawyer, if they have one, and the ACLU. She says the ACLU can help people find volunteer attorneys if they don't have legal representation already. During her visit in Juneau, Kimmel also gave a talk for the Juneau World Affairs Council. She mentioned the impact immigrant communities have on Alaska. She says, as of 2023, immigrants pay about $500 million in taxes and spend nearly $2 billion in Alaska each year.
That's not chump change, especially for a state that has been struggling mightily recently with a budget. This goes for all immigrants, including people who are here without documents in our state.
And she says economics are only some of the benefits migrants bring to the state. In Juneau, I'm Yvonne Cromery.
Kimmel's full presentation on immigration law can be found on KTOO 360 TV's YouTube channel. Future ACLU virtual and in-person trainings can be found at acluak.org/events. 10 Juneau High School students gained real-world home-building experience and some much-needed vitamin D earlier this month during a school district trip to Maui, Hawaii. There, the students spent several days rebuilding homes destroyed by the wildfires that devastated the town of Lahaina in 2023. The Juneau School District's House Build program teaches hands-on construction skills by building new, energy-efficient homes in Juneau. Students enrolled in the program are eligible to join the annual Habitat for Humanity build trip in Hawaii. Jace Kilmeyer is a senior at Juneau Douglas High School Yadaotkathle and a house build student. Kilmeyer says this year was his second trip with the program.
I feel like it has a positive impact because you're
learning, but also it's always nice and it feels fulfilling to know that you are helping a community or helping someone out, which can have a positive effect on your mental state.
Andy Bullock teaches the program and has brought dozens of students over the past decade on the trip. He says the homes the students worked on were originally built by other students in 2019 and 2020. However, those homes burned down during the 2023 wildfires. Bullock says though the opportunity came from tragedy, he and the students had a great time rebuilding the homes and connecting with the community.
The bigger deal is just the inspiration for these kids to go somewhere cool, to meet new people, to see different cultures, to go on a really amazing trip and to meet people, to understand the need for affordable housing for people, and then to be able to actively help address that need while having a good time.
The students helped hang drywall and install siding, but in their free time, the students hit the beach to snorkel and took a whale watching trip. They returned to Juneau before recent storms hit Hawaii, causing historic flooding in parts of the islands. Bullock said the homes they worked on are not being impacted. A construction site in downtown Anchorage got a splash of color recently thanks to the city's Beyond the Beige initiative. Passersby in the vicinity of the construction site near 4th Avenue and G Street, a redevelopment of what's known as Block 41, can now see a local art installation along the fence surrounding it. Officials unveiled the first 10 of 25 panels Thursday. Cabin Fever Fabric, Fiber, and Gifts founder Jana Hyanga pitched the idea and received the grant last year. Ivy Sponholz, a former Democratic state representative, is the current owner of Cabin Fever.
The construction, while the end is going to be really exciting, the messy middle when construction is taking place can be kind of disruptive to local businesses. And so Jana's idea was to, you know, turn it into an outdoor art gallery displaying, amazing Alaskan art.
The installation at Block 41 is part of a broader city beautification effort called Beyond the Beige, a reference to a bland color some say is too prevalent in Anchorage. Mayor Suzanne LaFrance created the grant-funded public arts initiative in partnership with the Anchorage Community Development Authority in 2025. Block 41 is a roughly $200 million mixed-use tower that will feature retail space, housing, and a new parking garage. It's been under construction since 2022. Artist Anne Marie Henderson with Studio Gallery across the street has a piece in the new installation.
And it's just a net positive for everyone. It's a net positive for me as an artist and just for the casual walker by on G Street. So it's really awesome to see these things come to fruition and be real.
Last year, the Beyond the Beige grant program dispersed $100,000 among 14 recipients using $50,000 from the mayor's office that the Anchorage Community Development Authority matched. Each of the artists' work at Block 41 are available for sale at galleries in the area. The artwork will be on display until the Block 41 construction is finished and the fences are removed in early 2027. Applications for this year's grants are due by Monday. For more information, visit the Anchorage Community Development Authority website. Well, Petersburg's elementary school will be getting new accessible playground equipment next school year. It's part of a $170,000 grant the school district received for special education. As KFSK's Taylor Heckert reports, it will help pay for equipment that focuses on students with limited mobility.
The playground at Petersburg's Racy Stedman Elementary School has swings, slides, monkey bars, and lots of things to climb on. But if you're a student who's in a wheelchair or has limited mobility, playing on that equipment may be difficult or impossible. That's where this new playground equipment comes in. Here's Special Education Director Cindy Fry.
The idea is, and the need of it is, to have a playground where our students who have accessibility concerns, either limited physical and or if they are in wheelchairs or alternative movement devices, they can have places where their peers can come join them and it's at their level and it's interactive.
The district has received $170,000 in grant funding from the Hurstwood Education Foundation, a nonprofit that supports special education projects in schools. About $128,000 will be used to completely cover the costs of new equipment. The remaining money will be used on professional development for special education staff. Fry says only a handful of elementary students have limited mobility, about 10 or less. But it's still important to include these students at recess. Superintendent Robin Taylor agrees.
This allows them to be down there with their peers, interacting with their peers.
Fry says they're planning on adding an art station, a music station, and an area for removable sand or water tables. They'll extend the existing covered structure on the playground, so this area will be dry too. She says this equipment will be something that all kids can use.
So it's not targeting just those students who specifically need to be able to access and one way or another, but it's something that every single kid can choose if that's what they choose to engage in.
And she says these additions to the playground will offer options for kids who have different play styles at recess.
Not every student really wants to run around or go on the slides. Like, there's those kids who are just a little bit more quiet, maybe a little bit more artistic, and this will be a great place for all of those students, or any kid, really.
The district hopes to get the new playground equipment installed this summer. In Petersburg, I'm Taylor Heckert.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Eric Stone, Yvonne Crumrie, and Clarice Larson in Juneau, Evan Erickson in Bethel, Tim Ellis in Delta Junction, Sydney Dauphiné in Ketchikan, Michaela Finnerty in Anchorage, and Taylor Heckert in Petersburg. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Crystal Hyde, Kirsten Dobroth is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.